This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Wednesday, April 3rd. Former Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole says he blames Chinese interference for the loss of some seats in the 2021 election. We'll talk to O'Toole about his testimony at the inquiry into foreign interference. Plus, the federal government says it will bypass provinces that stand in the way of its housing goals by working directly with municipalities. Coming up, the mayor of Toronto on how that all could work, and the Power Panel on who voters will back in this political battle. Well, a number of politicians who claim they've been targeted by China are testifying today at the Foreign Interference Inquiry. Among them, former Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole. He says foreign interference not only cost the Conservatives up to 9 seats in the 2021 election, but it also may have cost him his job as party leader. Former Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole joins me now. Mr. O'Toole, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back.
You said today that the misinformation pushed by China probably cost your party about 9 seats in the 2021 election, but it didn't cost you the government overall. How can you be so sure it was limited to that kind of an effect?
Well, I've always said that was my estimate. I used a range of up to 9 seats because of two things. We heard reports and saw evidence of misinformation in a handful of ridings in the Vancouver region and the Toronto area. And then our modeling... We did, for the first time, our party did behavioral predictive modeling that was extremely accurate everywhere in the country, with the exception of a dozen or so ridings, and you superimpose those and some of the results. I think there was enough misinformation and voter suppression to perhaps change the outcome in as many as that. It's all speculation, and it's all part of the reason I've been calling for an inquiry, a nonpartisan professional inquiry, for a few years. But it's also why I never spoke about this after the election. I respected the result too much. I lost, and we moved on. But we did want to make sure that the task force and some of the mechanisms looking at misinformation and interference stepped up their game before the next election.
You made that point today. You're pretty emphatic that you didn't want to go public with concerns in any way suggesting that the integrity itself wasn't valid. I know your traditional conservative belief in institutions, but was it all? How much of that was fueled by what we saw in the United States and January 6th and all of the big lie things we've seen in America?
Well, both were part of my consideration, David. And it was proven right that when the Globe and Mail stories did come out a year later, Jennifer O'Connell, a neighboring MP of mine, made the direct comparison to election denialism in the United States. So we were very careful to just, after the election, we lost, we won the popular vote, and there were a number of reasons we lost. But in some seats where there was evidence of misinformation and interference, we continued to work with officials quietly behind the scenes just to make sure that the lessons were learned so that we can improve our systems. And for me, I've thought a public inquiry is the way to show the public, particularly voters in those areas, particularly voters from diaspora communities, that we are taking it seriously. We're taking their vote just as seriously as the overall result, because we do have 338 elections on Election Day. And the party with the most seats in the House of Commons forms government. That's how our system works.
Right. So on a macro level, you're convinced the election was fair. But there are these micro battles, like Kenny Chu, for example, holds to this day that he lost Steve's in Richmond East because of interference here. And I remember on this program a year ago, last year, speaking with the late Ian Shugart about this, who was part of the task force that looked into this. And his argument was that I think they would only go public and sound alarms on interference if it was broad enough and big enough to affect the big picture, and that going public on something that might be limited in scope in specific ridings could itself have a disruptive effect on the election by doing that in the middle of the campaign. What are your thoughts on that? Because I know you have some concerns about how this was handled.
Look, I have great respect for Mr. Shugart, and I think he was a fine public servant, but I think the collective decision made by this panel was incorrect. They had evidence of fairly widespread efforts. In fact, their own documents said there was a campaign of misinformation. The public notice, David, could have been very localized with almost a scalpel to a number of ridings saying to those Canadians, be very cautious with what you're seeing on WeChat and certain platforms.
It's tough to be that surgical in the internet age, though.
But this is what we have to do. Because I'll tell you, had I put out a notice like this, I would have been accused of fomenting anti-Asian discrimination. That was the narrative the Prime Minister had in the House when we were asking questions on the Winnipeg lab document situation, is be very careful not to inflame these tensions. So how do you take the politics out of this and make sure that our national security is respected and the democratic rights of each Canadian is respected? I'm not suggesting it's easy, David.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm hoping the inquiry can do this, because when they're not even sharing with us documents showing that there were misinformation efforts, and a small group of five people make a determination that, well, it's not going to affect enough results to even warn people, that I think was imprudent.
Right, because this was something you saw today, documents from the Security and Intelligence Threat Election Task Force. This is the committee we're talking about, known as SITE, a bunch of senior civil servants, you know, who hold significant positions in the government of Canada. And this document outlined how China was directing a disinformation campaign against your party, largely because of your positions on China. You never saw that, your campaign team never saw that. Am I correct in understanding that?
We never saw that. And in fact, the task force and the panel kind of lulled us into a state of complacency to say, yeah, everything's being taken care of. There were no issues in 2019, is what they told us at the beginning. That's obviously not been true. We've heard about the financial improprieties. And we were kind of lulled into a complacency. And I think even the well-meaning senior officials on that committee are a little naive to just how advanced some of these foreign interference measures are. And we don't have proper line of sight into platforms like WeChat, like TikTok. Mm-hmm. The Western world is struggling on how best to balance free speech, which is foundational to our democracy. But realizing some of this speech is controlled and actually manipulated by foreign state actors means I think we have to be a bit more cautious.
But how do you do that? Like, this is the great tension in a country like Canada, which has ingrained rights of expression that are protected. How do you stop WeChat, whether it's any of the Meta products, Twitter, TikTok, the Global Times, from spreading things that can have an influence without resorting to what would amount to censorship?
Well, two things. The Americans, and rarely do Democrats and Republicans agree on things, as you know, David, they agreed on making TikTok divest. I've heard a lot of people say ban TikTok. They said no, they don't want the communist regime in Beijing to be able to control an entire platform that a quarter of the U.S. population uses and can map people based on where they live and how they use and their views. So I think there's a difference between who should own and control these platforms versus how people and people in the free world use them. And in WeChat, you can warn people and educate people that the information you're receiving here is coming from a source that can't be trusted. And I think it's a bit of caveat emptor, buyer beware, you know, with Canadians that aren't on WeChat and don't come from the diaspora community probably don't realize that it's an app for everything.
Yeah.
And it allows people to stay in touch. So there's more voters in parts of Vancouver that get their news from that single channel than CBC, CTV, Global, all of them combined. And so we have to look at how do we at least make sure that they're not getting a message that is adverse to our values and rights.
It's tough, though, because the party you once led, you know, they are very anti-censorship, internet regulation, support for traditional media. They see that as government buying speech. So it seems to me it would be difficult to get a consensus to take this sort of directed action at any kind of an app. Or do you think the Conservatives could come around on this?
I have never said it's going to be simple.
No, I wasn't suggesting.
The one thing I think, you know, the way Mr. Trudeau has done sort of bailouts to media, mm-hmm. other countries have done different things, you know, recognize different intellectual property rights for certain media sources. The French have done that. You know, there was the arbitration and the baseball approach that Australia had. There's a variety of ways that countries are looking at this. But I think the most important thing is, if a platform is controlled and the algorithms are controlled by an adversarial country, China, Russia, we heard about today, we should be very, very careful about how important they are to our political discourse. Do we make them be divested, like TikTok, the debate they're having in the U.S.? That's one option. Also warning and educating folks about, hey, use this to stay in touch with your family in China. Use this for purchases and things like this. Do not use this as a news source. And I think the people we owe this inquiry to the most are actually Chinese Canadians who come here for the democratic freedoms that they would not have had in China. We owe it to them to make sure that they're not pressured into not voting or they're misled on something because they use a platform that is helpful for them to keep in touch with family.
You testified today that the interference didn't cost you the election, may have cost some seats, but you did suggest it may have cost you your leadership in two respects. One, had you won 5 or 6 more seats, you might have been over a threshold where it would have been more tenable for you to stay. But in your prior interviews, before you were on the stand today, you suggested that Bert Chen, who was a former national director, I believe, with the party, who went public with a petition to have you removed as leader within 48 hours of the election, you suggested you had information from sources that he had relations with the People's Republic of China, and that could have motivated what he did there. What do you believe to be true about that?
Well, let me unpack that. As I said in my hours of interviews with Inquiry Counsel, there were a lot of reasons that the caucus voted me out as leader. A lot of them ranged on vaccine measures and my attempts to balance off climate and a whole range of that. And I talked about that. But one issue was this very early call for a leadership review led by Mr. Chen, but also based on the fact that I had fallen 2 seats short from the 2019 threshold for the party. Now, it was a very different election. There was no pandemic. There was no vaccine issue. But I'll tell you, another 5 seats, David, might have given me a little bit of a toehold to sort of say, look, we've made progress. It would have been the largest opposition in Canadian history. But I'm very happy in the private sector now. I'm very proud of my time in politics. I'm participating and being very transparent because I want our system to be safeguarded for next time. So certain things in my report were told to me by people. I have no verifiable evidence with respect to Mr. Chen or anyone else. But I do think, you know, sunshine is the great disinfectant. We need to have more transparency.
Because Mr. Chen has said he was born in Taiwan. His family fought against the communist government of China. So you were, passing that on to the inquiry for its information as opposed to laying it on the record as a claim? How would you describe your decision to share that?
I had about probably 7 hours of interviews with counsel. I was very transparent, shared documents, much like I had with Mr. Johnson, too, the special rapporteur. Mm-hmm. And anything that came up that I thought was relevant, I always said, much like intelligence, David, intelligence is just an indicator. It is not evidence. And so intelligence I gain from diaspora organizations or from journalists, much of it came after my time as leader, but I've never spoken about it publicly. I didn't even speak about the foreign interference until maybe 6 months after I stopped being leader on a podcast with Nathaniel Erskine-Smith. I'm now talking about it because this is the inquiry that has a chance to look at all these things. And I think all Canadians should want the inquiry to do well because our democracy is so important.
Aaron O'Toole, always appreciate the time. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Aaron O'Toole wasn't the only one to testify today at the Foreign Interference Inquiry. Several other politicians who claim they have also been targeted by China also spoke. CBC's Karina Roman joins us now from the inquiry. So, Karina, we heard from former Conservative MP Kenny Chiu, who was defeated in 2021. What did Kenny Chiu have to say today?
Well, he blames foreign interference at least as one factor, a major factor in his loss in 2021. Most of it to do with his private member's bill to create a foreign agent registry that he says was misconstrued and completely contorted on platforms like WeChat in terms of misinformation, that he was a target of one of the bigger misinformation, disinformation campaigns that allegedly was orchestrated by the Communist Party in China. He said he tried to combat that disinformation when he started to hear about it and get a sense of it, but it was very difficult to do face-to-face with enough people, and very difficult to do when he noticed such a difference in campaigning from 2019 to 2021, where he said in 2021, houses that had been perfectly friendly and even put up lawn signs for him previously were now closing the door in his face and telling him that he hated China and he hated them. Then, of course, there are the revelations, as you just discussed with Aaron O'Toole, that there was evidence that the site task force and CSIS had of the very things that they were observing in terms of potential foreign interference. He said he was frustrated to hear that, you know, he was going through this and they knew he was going through this. And he said at the time even, he just felt very abandoned by, you know, the powers that be who could do something about it. Have a listen to what he had to say.
I thought I would be protected by my country, and I was deeply troubled, disappointed that I was exposed, and the government doesn't seem to care. And now that through the commission, I've learned that they've known all about it. It's almost like I was drowning, and they are watching. And the best they could do, by the way, is to let me know that I'm drowning.
And then he went on to say he didn't need to be told he was drowning. He needed help. And that help could have been something like a public warning to people about the disinformation they were seeing. But none of that came. He was also asked, David, what he would do differently if now what he knows going back in time. And he said he might not have actually run if he'd known how it was all going to turn out.
Okay, interesting stuff there from Kenny Chu. We've heard a lot from conservatives on this, but there's also New Democrats who are testifying today, or a New Democrat. Jenny Kwan is still on the stand. She's. What have we heard from Jenny Kwan so far?
So she was asked about her advocacy for human rights, especially for Hong Kong, because that is where she's from. She talked about protests in front of the Chinese consulate. And then, as her advocacy stepped up, what she observed in terms of constituents, for example, coming up to her and whispering that they're afraid to be associated with voting for her, even though we have a secret ballot system, or fear for her that she's doing these things, especially by seniors in her community. Then she talked about concerns that they started having about community events being infiltrated by the Communist Party of China when she and other major Chinese people who have been outspoken were suddenly not invited to very significant events in the riding, whether we're talking about the opening of a Chinese museum or other things, and how that became quite obvious to her. And then, of course, David, the free lunch story. So we've all heard about during the election in 2021 how her liberal rival was offered or sponsored with a free lunch for people who might want to come and support him, and this was held by Fred Kwok, who is with the Chinese Benevolent Association of Vancouver, which has alleged ties to the CCP, and they noted this invite on WeChat for this free lunch, and she said that, you know, originally they were like, well, is this even legal? Who's hosting it? Is a registered third party? If there's no limit on the numbers, then what does this mean for actual campaign contributions? So they did file a complaint with the Elections Commission. And there was a financial penalty, an administrative penalty, and so that case is closed. It was really only later, when all these other little tidbits started coming up, that they started realizing, wait, actually, this might have been foreign interference. And so she talked, you know, about whether or not what sort of started getting them to think that that might have been behind it, and that Beijing might have been behind it through proxy agents in the Vancouver area.
Okay, so Karina, as we've been speaking, Jenny Kwan has just finished. Michael Chong is now in the chair to begin his testimony at the inquiry. Quickly, I mean, what do you think we can expect to hear from Michael Chong? He's been one of the most vocal politicians in the House of Commons on this issue for a while now.
When you think about how it was all revealed that he was a target through newspaper articles, through the Globe and Mail, that his family perhaps might be targeted, and that he found this out through media reports as opposed to from, you know, CSIS and other agencies that would have known about this. You get a sense that might be something that gets talked about during this testimony, because there is this common theme hearing today from the various MPs, regardless of party. They were all finally given briefings when this started to become a big news story, you know, in 2023. And they said those briefings that were more specific than the general briefings that MPs get were very helpful, very useful, if only they had had it years ago. So you get this sense that, you know, what is this natural tendency to hold back information from the very people who need that information to protect themselves and also to guard against foreign interference in our democracy.
Okay, Karina, thank you so much. The Prime Minister made another budget announcement today, this one to speed up new home building and apartment building, and he wants the provinces to buy in with funding of their own. But Ontario Premier Doug Ford says how and where cities spend the money should be up to them.
I'm going to leave that up to each municipality to decide because they know better than the province and the federal government.
If the province doesn't want to step up with ambition on building the infrastructure needed to support more housing in general across the province, we'll do it specifically with willing partners.
Okay, here's what those willing partners are going to be required to do, and this is why it's such an issue in Ontario. To access the $5 billion they put on the table, the federal government yesterday, for municipal infrastructure, provinces have to order fourplexes as a bare minimum right across the jurisdiction, and Doug Ford says he doesn't want to do that. So, a political battle between two governments that have been getting along until this week. Cheryl Evelyn, Jordan Likens, Tim Powers, and Amanda Alvaro, they're the Power Panel. They're back with me on this. Tim, what do you make of this? It was so good for so long between Justin Trudeau and Doug Ford, and now there's tension brewing over housing and strings on billions and the carbon tax.
I guess as a relationship expert, David, you're coming to me on that. Things ending. I'm pretty good at that. you set me up. Thank you. What do I?
You picked up the own bus and rolled under it. But anyway, go ahead.
I did. Metro bus. They had it though. They had a racket around childcare on this when that initially came out, and they did find a way to find an accord on that. I think two things here. I think the Prime Minister is trying hard every day with billions of dollars to show that he gets affordability and what's the challenge of affordability that people are feeling. Housing's a big issue. So he's not afraid to fight on this one because, as we were discussing moments ago off air, you know, what does he have to lose at this point? Every premier's coming at him so he can go hard back at him. I think Doug Ford, as he has done with other federal programs, that initially his instinct is to react, he will watch. He will watch and see how this plays out. Because if there is political benefit for him here, I think he may change his tune over time, as was the case with child care. So I don't know how long of a fight this will be and how long somebody's sleeping on the sofa or the spare bedroom here, but these two need each other, right? There's so much in history that demonstrates, you know, it's beneficial for a federal Liberal government to have a provincial, what do they call it, the Urquhart theory or something, when one is red, the other is blue. That works politically. It's been proven to be true for 75 years in Ontario. So they will find a way to have the right fight, the right tone, and find a solution if one is needed when the time comes.
So, Amanda, though, it's been interesting to watch what the government has done for the past week or so now, that this is not like a budget rollout, which happens after the budget. This is more like an election platform reveal. And they're responding to a bunch of issues that the premiers and the opposition have said, this is your problem, you need to fix it. And now they're laying out solutions, and the provinces are saying, we don't like that. Because, you know, we wanted a seat at the table, we don't like these stakes. I mean, how do you think this will play out politically with the federal government coming in with its spending power, but insisting on certain things that are not in their jurisdiction, but where they're wearing some political damage?
Well, this is why this strategy works so well, and why I'm such a fan of it. And you've laid it out perfectly. It's because it's really been set up as problem solution. For a long time, the Prime Minister has been the punching bag of all of the problems. And the Liberal Party, I would argue, hasn't done a very good job in terms of communicating in kind. Now they have a communication strategy that they've put together where the problems have been laid out by mainly the Conservative opposition leader in the form of like long form videos, There is a crisis. We all have to be aware of the crisis, and the crisis falls on the shoulders of the prime minister. Well, now the prime minister and the government is rolling out all of these solutions. And the problem with creating this idea of let's tack all of the issues on the prime minister is that when they do come to the table with a solution and you're not willing to accept the solution, then the problem shifts to you. The onus now falls on the premiers. And what I really loved about today's narrative or yesterday's narrative was this idea that if you're not ambitious enough as a province, or if you're going to stand away in the way of housing for the people in your province, then we're just going to go ahead and go around you and work with the municipalities. I think it is a very short stay before Doug Ford rethinks his position on this one.
So, Jordan, it's interesting because I remember when the premiers all got together, I believe it was in Nova Scotia, and they said, stop going around us and doing deals with the cities. We want you to do what you did in Quebec, where you did your housing accelerator deal with François Legault. But François Legault put money into that deal.
That's right.
And the other premiers have not had to do that with the deals with the municipalities. This is one that calls for them to do certain things, which was kind of what they negotiated with Quebec. I just wonder how you think this may play in this argument.
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, I think that the friction that the prime minister is creating here with Ford is likely it's a good fight for him. And this is really all about counter-programming on the carbon tax. So we're still in and around the April 1st period. Mm. They really needed to get out, especially over the long weekend, with a narrative that created a little bit more space on different issues for them. And I think that they were able to do that. The question that I have is that even if they're able to gain that space in the media, does that trickle down to voters at all? Is any of this making an impression beyond that? And I'm not so sure there. I do think that in this case, the fight with Ford is favorable. I think it's less good for Ford because one starts to get the impression that the Ontario government is interested in doing anything possible for housing, particularly if it might enrich developer friends, but not something that might anger NIMBYs, right? And so you start to run into a problem when it looks like you're willing to, for example, tear up your promises on the Greenbelt fairly easily if somebody can make some significant money on it, but you're not willing to put in four units in a fourplex, which was recommended, by the way, 2 years ago by his own housing affordability task force, because it might offend some people in Etobicoke. Like, and I think he's got to pick a lane on that. Now, Ford is a flexible politician. He is a populist to the core. So if he watches and he sees the wind blowing another way on this, I'd expect him to sing a very different tune in a week or two.
Well, yeah, Sherelle, I mean, he's the champion of municipal autonomy. And 5 years ago, he cut the Toronto City Council in half and opposed strong mayor powers over the objections of some municipal governments. But, you know, apparently you can't tell them to do fourplexes. But, you know, there's billions on the table now that weren't on the table when he made that decision. I mean, where do you think this one goes?
I mean, well, yeah, you took the kind of the words right out of my mouth there. It was like hearing Doug Ford say that, you know, you don't believe in forcing municipalities. It's like, was I asleep? Did I dream all of that where you did force municipalities to bend to your whims? But yeah, there's a lot of money on the table. And I think, and we saw that, you know, with healthcare, and they wanted money, but they wanted absolutely no strings attached to do with it what they will. And the federal government said, nah, that's not going to fly. We want actual outcomes here because we know what happens when there aren't those strings attached. All of a sudden, somebody has a surplus and, you know, things are still in dire straits. So it's going to be really difficult, I think, to sell it to as a premier's, to sell it to their own residents, to say, oh, well, here's the federal government coming in and telling us what they can do, what we can do in our own communities. Meanwhile, everybody's kind of looking around, trying to buy a home, not being able to do so because their own provincial leaders are standing in the way of that, or if it could get framed that they're standing in the way of that. So I do think it's going to be a bit of a different fight because, like you said, because of the money that's involved, because of the conditions that are involved, all of those other things. But I think it is a good fight for, as Jordan said, it is a good fight for the Prime Minister to tackle, just because everybody kind of really piled on him when he said there aren't a lot of levers that as a federal government we can pull to fix the housing crisis. And everybody got really mad at that. And they said, you're the prime minister, do something. And now he's saying, okay, bet.
Yeah.
And can I just pick up on what Sherelle said? Yep. And it's also an attempt by the prime minister, not just to get back in the game, as we're all saying, because he has to do that if he wants any chance of winning the next election. But it's also very targeted at the millennials and the Gen Zers who have left him significantly. Didn't when they won in 2015, they won with millennials who used to be parked mostly with the NDP. Mm-hmm. What we have seen in our data, and I think every other polling company has too, is the switch over the last 3 or 4 years from millennials and now with the emergence of Gen Z caring about the environment to switching about affordability, which most often translates to, am I living at mom and dad's and granddad's until I'm 45 when I can afford a home, or am I going to get one? So when those voters hear the cacophony of, oh, no, it's your fault, it's my fault, they don't give a damn about that.
Right.
They want to reward, the group that actually gets something done there. So again, if you're the prime minister, to step back into the era of Mulroney, why not roll the dice, right? You have nothing really to lose. And the final point I'd make is the premiers right now are also watching this a little bit, because Justin Trudeau, in just about every major poll, with the exception of the Nanos one that came out this week, is well behind Pierre Poilievre.
Sure.
So doing any favors to Justin Trudeau, being positive for Justin Trudeau, probably doesn't necessarily help them right now with that gap. If it changes, maybe the tune changes a bit.
I look at the jurisdiction squabbles, Jordan, and I get the Constitution matters, all right? And I get jurisdiction.
Peter Russell would be happy.
But I get that jurisdiction matters. But, I remember being here during the occupation of the downtown, and when the people responsible don't act, and shift the blame to somebody else, what are they supposed to do in a practical sense, mm-hmm. and on the necessity of dealing with a problem? So, the conditions that are there may be unacceptable to the Premier of Ontario, but the conditions are what the housing experts say needs to be done. And if the province isn't going to do it, they're trying to force it from the federal level, right?
Yeah, and I think you're correct to say that. I mean, voters really mostly don't care about that constitutional division of powers.
And they don't like experts,
that's
either.
That's right. So I think that it's always smart to bet against arguing on machinery of government and mm-hmm. arguing instead for the delivery of the things people need. And I think that in this case, it's interesting. I think they're taking a lot of inspiration from what's happened in BC.
Yep.
So David Eby's really been leading the charge on this. In fact, some of the mechanisms announced today,
policies are mirrored each other.
They're mirrored each other. And, it's been very effective in BC in providing a shield for Eby against some of the eroding popularity on affordability issues. And so I think there's a hope that could do the same for the feds. Now, I think it's interesting for the Liberals because, of course, they're in the confidence and supply agreement with the NDP. And the more you sort of edge into that territory of NDP policy, I think you can also potentially risk a place where that flips. And, if voters are really, truly voting on who's going to invest the most public money in affordable housing, well, do they want to choose Justin Trudeau again, or do they want to vote for a party that has really a long history and solid branding on that? So I think it's an interesting dance to watch him do it, but he really has no other choice at this point. He has to go out. He has to fight. He's got to throw some punches.
Right. And I mean, beyond the politics, there is now a severe policy focus on a lot of these issues that whatever the jurisdiction and whatever is in charge, that and credit to Pierre Poilievre, he harnessed this issue and harnessed the narrative by jumping on it. It now has people rolling out budgets weeks before the budget and saying, here's how you're going to build houses in Toronto one way or another. Your sense of the total package here of what they're rolling out and its ability to actually move the dial on the housing inventory in the country.
Well, what's been said by fellow panelists, a lot of these are either based on what other jurisdictions are doing really well that is helping to solve the housing crisis, or it's based on what the experts are saying is absolutely necessary. So, I agree that when you look at what's standing between me and affordable housing, what's standing between me and getting out of my parents' basement, if that mark falls on the premier, that's where it falls. And I think that's why, obviously, the government has taken this approach to say, we will go around whatever barrier stands between us and this problem that exists that is, has wrapped the nation. This is the number one issue, affordability, housing. And whether that issue was made by the conservative leader or not, it falls on the shoulders of the prime minister and the current government. And they have the benefit of the next year and a half to talk about all of the ways that they are solving the problem. But also looking at when those agreements are due. If you look at the agreements with the provinces are due by January of 2025, and with the territories by April of 2025, think about the fact that they can talk about all of those agreements coming to fruition, and then talk about the rollout of those projects, the infrastructure funds, and where they'll go and the projects that will happen all the way up until election day. So it provides them with a nice runway of announceables as they head into the next election as well.
Okay, Cheryl, just a quick final point. A runway of announceables, but not enough runway to have a bunch of houses built. But but the criticism for so long was they had no plan. This looks like a plan. You can sell this as a plan. Is it just too little, too late? How do you think people will react to it, given how long this has been an issue and how long it's taken them to act?
Yeah, something that Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre has been hammering the government on is, well, he's talked about photo ops and mm-hmm. how they're not actually building houses. So they have until October 2025. It's great to have a plan, but if people are still looking at plans and not looking at, you know, okay, here are the keys in my hand, yeah. It's not going to get them that far if they don't actually see a tangible benefit.
Yeah, or at least a bunch of for sale signs are going up in the neighborhood.
All the way.
All right, gang, we got to leave it there. Thank you so much to the Power Panel, Amanda Alvaro, Jordan Leichnitz, Tim Powers, and Cheryl Evelyn. Ottawa announced an additional $15 billion for provinces to build more apartments today. The top-up is part of Ottawa's plan to tackle the growing housing crisis. And just yesterday, the Prime Minister announced a $6 billion infrastructure and housing fund for provinces and municipalities, but the money comes with strings attached. One of the conditions being provinces must allow cities to build fourplexes as of right, which Ontario Premier Doug Ford has been adamant is a massive mistake.
I don't believe in forcing municipalities. I believe in working with municipalities. I've walked a mile in their shoes, and I'm going to leave that up to each municipality to decide, because they know better than the province and the federal government.
If the province doesn't want to step up with ambition on building the infrastructure needed to support more housing in general across the province, we'll do it specifically with willing partners. Ideally, we work with the province. If not, I know Olivia has always already told me, hey, send the extra money to Toronto. We'll build more homes. We want to keep growing.
Olivia Chow is the mayor of Toronto, and she joins me now. Mayor Chow, welcome back to the show.
Hi.
I was looking at this announcement today, and I saw the mayor of Canada's largest city with the prime minister. I did not see the premier or a provincial minister, and there is some disagreement on this housing policy the federal government is rolling out. Are you worried about cities getting caught in a jurisdictional battle between the federal and provincial governments here?
Not at all, because I believe every political leaders want to build housing, want to build affordable housing. So I think it's just some of the interpretation of local city zoning bylaws. At the end of the day, it's the city that delivers the services, the approval for developers to build housing. So I think we can cross all the bridges that need to be crossed.
But a big condition that Sean Fraser and the Prime Minister put on the table with the $5 billion fund yesterday was that provinces have to make fourplexes available everywhere they want to be built in Ontario. And Doug Ford has decided he doesn't want to do that as premier. He wants to leave it to municipalities. I know you're on board with that, but how do you think this could affect things here in Ontario?
I'm not sure, but what I do know is that Premier Ford is very much supportive of local democracy and want to leave it for the city to approve these fourplexes. The city of Toronto has already done so, so mm-hmm. it's not a barrier for us. We have actually checked all the boxes that the federal government have required, whether it's student or having housing near post-secondary education area, faster approval process, less parking requirement, all of those details. We've met all the requirements or in a pipeline in a month or two to meet those requirements. So it's not a problem for us. Mm. And I know that Premier Ford understand that the city has been very cooperative with both the provincial and the federal government. So I don't see any conflict as far as what the city can do in accessing the funds, the Build Canada Fund, the Canada Builds Fund,
right.
The low-cost financing plus the actual dollar. The accelerator fund, for example, that was approved last year for the city of Toronto, we have already received the first installment. And David, let me tell you, between the accelerator fund and Canada Builds Fund's low-cost financing, the city can build enough homes very quickly for 30,000 Torontonians. That's exciting. We have 198 projects ready to go. And so 98 of them are shoveling the ground. The other half are in the pipeline.
So as far as you're concerned, this is effective policy, right? Because your city and the region around your city, that's the housing market along with the Vancouver area that's really troubling for young people and working income people to get into. So you say you're on board with fourplexes. You've made that change. The premier says he's worried about pushback. Did you get a lot of pushback in Toronto when you decided to do this as a mayor and as a council? Because everybody who advocates on the housing file says this is what needs to happen. What was the reaction to it in your experience for going that way?
Well, the changes are never simple or easy. However, there was consensus in the city of Toronto. There are some councillors that voted for it. Majority of the councillors voted for it. And there is a consensus that we need to build housing. We need to make life affordable for everyone. And I can understand why Premier Ford don't want to impose his will on other cities. And other cities may say, hey, this is for us to decide. That's really up to the premier to decide on what he prefer, how he wants to do this. But one way or another, the federal program said that if the province don't want to make that decision, the municipalities can. And as long as the municipalities are following our guidelines, the funds will flow anyway. Mm-hmm. So, which is for us, that's just fine. Whether it's through Ontario or directly to us, either way, as long as we get the funds, we're happy. We will build. And we can't wait.
So if we look at the two programs that have rolled out the last 2 days, there's extra money for the apartment building loan program to help give low-cost mm-hmm. financing for apartment construction. And then there's the $5 billion plus the extra $1 billion that's on the table for municipal infrastructure that can unlock housing developments. How does Toronto use that money, that infrastructure money? Like, what are the things that are missing in the city of Toronto right now that this money lets you do that will open up, unlock future housing developments?
Well, infrastructure is critically important, and every municipal leaders will tell you that. The Federation of Canadian Municipalities said that. And, well, whether it's roads, sewers, bridges for some other municipalities, but local community centers, libraries, parks, just even paving the roads for some of the area, all of those are important. Public transit is critical because you can't just, in the waterfront of Toronto, for example, there's a lot of development. If we just develop it without actually building an LRT, which has been on the books, then people are landlocked and then they right. can't get anywhere without driving. And then congestion is so bad that we are losing $11 billion productivity. So is there enough funds to build a waterfront LRT? No, but there may be enough funds. We don't know yet. Depends on how much they give to the city of Toronto, for example. There may be enough transit fund for us to put in the order to purchase the new subway cars from one right. of our subway lines. If we don't do that, those old subway cars are end of its lifespan. The provincial government's on site, the city is putting the money, their contribution, the federal contribution will unlock $1.6 billion so we can get the order in. The sooner we do that, the better.
Okay.
So I can't wait. Can't wait for the budget to be announced.
Well, I was going to say, right there, you jumped ahead. That's the future transit fund, right? That we're going to get, who knows? They're announcing everything in the budget before the budget. So we'll definitely get it by budget day. And that's something you've done, the density changes that they're requiring for to be able to qualify for that. But the money they rolled out yesterday, the $1 billion for urgent infrastructure and the $5 billion
for provinces and territories that will flow to municipalities like yours if the provinces don't get on board with the conditions. What are the sorts of things that can be used for? Because that doesn't strike me as transit. Is that just water hookups and running roads and paving roads into areas that make it easier for builders to come in and put up houses at scale by sort of reducing the cost and freeing up your capacity? That's how that helps you. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes. But there's something that's really important. It's called complete neighborhood, complete right. communities. You can't just build all these condos and all these high-rises or townhouses, you know, 6-8 story, without a community center. Mm. Like, imagine if you have 10,000 people living in an area with no community center, no place for the kids to play, no playground. My God, you can't do that. No libraries, nothing. And no childcare center. That's just asking for trouble. So if you're looking at a really good neighborhood in downtown Toronto, if you look at the St. Lawrence neighborhood, it has a park, a community center, a school, a library. It is comprehensive, so people are happy there. You can't just build housing without those social infrastructure. And the question is, other than the hard infrastructure, who is going to pay for the social infrastructure? And childcare center costs right. plenty too, right? That might be from another budget. But all of it connecting together means that kids wouldn't have to be bused across town. There's actual place for kids to play. There's green space. All of that needs to be factored in. And of course, local municipalities only get 9 cents per dollar of all the taxes that are given. Taylor Swift is coming to Toronto. We're not going to get any of the economic benefits. We'll just have to pay the police a bit more money because so many people are coming into town. So we're looking really ultimately not just the infrastructure funds, because that's limited, right. but a way, a kind of revenue that could, as more and more people move into big cities, that a revenue that could grow the economy. And that's really ultimately what we're looking for.
Right. I take your point on the social infrastructure. It's not just a place to live. It's the place to have a life. And that's what it allows you to do. Olivia Chow, Mayor of Toronto, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.